To my dearest friends, I am honored to welcome you back once more for the final part on our long story detailing the rise and fall of the traitorous Primarch, known as Mortarion. Born as a son to the Emperor, this demigod was destined to walk as the Lord of the Death Guard, leading his legion on a great warpath to seize this galaxy for the glory of all mankind. But as we all know, even the best laid of plans can go awry. Fate cursed each of the Primarchs in their own way, and Mortarion was no exception, being led down a path most tragic, dooming both him and his entire legion to a foul unlife, quite unlike any other. We previously investigated the early life and origin tale of the Primarch, who led the liberation of his homeworld of Barbarus, freeing the forlorn humans from their nightmarish existence beneath the oppressive rule of the alien overlords. We then explored the downfall of the Death Guard, following the exploits of the first Captain Typhus, who misled Mortarion and his entire legion into accepting the malign gifts of Nurgle. But now, following directly from our prior episode, we should investigate the role that Mortarion played in the final and most climactic battle of the Horus Heresy, naturally being of the Siege of Terra. We will begin with Horus's assembly of the Conclave of Traitors and of the initial plans for their invasion before following the timeline of the Great Siege, witnessing the foul powers of Nurgle as they spread and corrupt the throne world of humanity. But with this in mind, we need no long introductions. And so, my dearest friends, I do believe that it is now time for us to begin. By this point in our tale, the galaxy has been set alight, the Imperium has been torn asunder, and Holy Terra itself suffers beneath a chaotic blockade, with the entirety of the Siege of Terra waiting only for the arrival of Mortarion and his Death Guard. It was the 14th year of the 31st millennium, and the young Imperium of Man was on the verge of collapse. The galaxy had been consumed by the flames of fratricidal rebellion, with the arch-traitor Horus, once trusted warmaster to the unstoppable armies of the Great Crusade, now leading 9 of the corrupted legions on a warpath set directly towards the old iron cradle of humanity. The time of the Emperor was rapidly coming to a close, and soon Horus would bring about his tainted ambitions of offering up the stars themselves as his final gift to the dark gods. Yet this goal could not be achieved whilst the Emperor still lived, and so Holy Terra itself was now destined to fall. Though not yet united with the rest of the traitor forces, within the bubonic flagship of the Terminus Est, we would find none other than of Mortarion, the pale king of Barbarus and demonic Primarch to the pestilent Death Guard. The once proud legion, originally named as the Dusk Raiders, had been deceived and perverted by their first captain Typhon, now known as Typhus, who had embraced the gifts of the Destroyer Plague, transforming them into a decayed host, loyal only to the god of all disease, Nurgle. None were spared from this sickening change, not even of Mortarion himself, who now stood as a fetid effigy of putrescence, forcibly ascended into a demon prince, whose very soul was now tainted with the irredeemable stain of rot. Their fleet, once lost, had been vomited forth from the roiling depths of the warp, bringing the scourge of the plague farther to the farthest outskirts of the Sol system. Every contaminated and festering vessel contained the sickening facsimile of the old Dusk Raiders within, with every marine now harboring the disgusting blight of the destroyer plague, their organs spilling out from corroded armors, flesh weeping with foul-smelling pus and blood. Next to the soulless husks of the Thousand Suns, the Legion of the Death Guard had suffered from perhaps the most calamitous metamorphosis, with there being no possible cure for their ruinous transformation. They painfully dragged their bloated forms through the twisted corridors, wading through the ankle-deep soup of warp-born detritus, from which spawned lesser demons clawing up, desperate for a taste of a mortal soul. Their armor, though always tarnished from their brutal wars, had since taken on the hues of gangrenous flesh, highlighted by the slick of unnatural pus, oozing forth from uncountable wounds and bursting pores. Mortarion, gene father to his forces, once believed that he could have prevented this outcome. But now his times for regret were long past, as his own embracement of the ruinous powers forever sealed their fate to be pawns for the noxious god of death. He had not, however, arrived within this system by mere chance, as by this point, the Warmaster Horus was assembling his forces for their final attack against the birthplace of all mankind. Within the Strategium of the Vengeful Spirit, the Lupercal surveyed the hololithic projection of Terra's defenses, his sunken face illuminated by the flickering glow, revealing the extent to which this child of the Emperor had truly fallen. He had always possessed a commanding presence, but since being touched by the powers of the warp, that charisma had been replaced with a sense of dominance, to which none could possibly hope to deny. The momentum of his rebellion had always demanded the siege of Terra, and yet he was not content with the current strength of his forces. Lorgar remained absorbed in heretical divination, with the majority of the Wordbearers being absent, as they continued in their unholy crusade against the Loyalists within Segmentum Ultima. Alpharius had supplied the detailed layout of Sol's defenses, yet had since departed from the vessel on an unknown mission, with only a scant few of his Alpha legionaries remaining to support the Warmaster. But Mortarion should have arrived. Abaddon, first captain to Horus, grew increasingly impatient, as with each passing hour, the Loyalists were provided with a growing opportunity to strengthen themselves. The Blood Angels continued to reinforce the Helios Gate. Rogel Dorn entrenched his fortifications deeper within the ancient soils, and the White Scars identified more locations from which to ambush the inevitable invaders. Yet, despite the valid protests from his advisors, Horus insisted on waiting, as his plans relied upon the unholy resilience of the Death Guard, seeing their legion as being utterly crucial for the initial attack. Down upon Terra, within the inner sanctum of the Imperial Palace, the three defending demigods assessed the coming storm, looking out across the site of their final stand, and at the millions who would soon fight and die in the defense of humanity. Sanguinius, Angel of Baal, briefly wondered if Mortarion's absence signaled a change of heart. Of all their fallen brothers, his hatred of the warp had been the most pronounced, and so perhaps the corruption of his allies might have given even the Death Lord a moment of pause. Dorn, however, rejected such sentiment, his views echoed by the Khan, who knew from their prior duel upon Prospero that Mortarion was utterly fixated on the death of their father, his hatred so fierce that it had entirely consumed him. The Pale King would inevitably come to Terra. his desire for revenge burning too brightly to possibly be extinguished by some desperate goal of redemption. Looking up, the malignant constellation of the traitor fleets, though distant, still grew to eclipse Terra's holy light. Fulgrim had brought his perverted troop. Perturabo assembled his great siege engines. Angren's dogs thirsted for blood. Magnus's husks silently obeyed. And at their center was Horus, flanked by his own sons, entirely loyal to the destructive commands of their heretical master. Though united in purpose, the turncoat primarchs still bickered and lashed out at one another, desperate to seek their own glory at the cost of all else. Angren, Fulgrim, and Perturabo each desired for their legion to take the vanguard and to be the first to land upon Terra, yet Horus still waited, only being willing to attack once the Death Guard made their approach. But in one moment, the disordered chaos of the Strategium came to a sickening halt, with their argumentative squabbling being replaced only with a united and overwhelming sense of disgust. The bulkhead doors opened, astropaths collapsed, warning signs flared, and emergency decontamination protocols activated as Mortarion himself, Ascendant Prince Tenurgle, trudged into the chamber. The child of Barbarus had always been tall, yet now, in his newly corrupted form, he seemed to tower over the room, stretching upwards as a figure of death incarnate. A tattered cloak of some putrescent material hung from two cracked pauldrons, meeting with two insectoid wings protruding from his open back, with his weeping spine on full display. His face should have been visible, yet it was partly obscured by a modified rebreather mask, leaking noxious vapors with each labored breath. As he lumbered towards the assembled primarchs, the mortal attendants nearest his path began to crumple, clawing at their own throats as his miasma of pestilence invaded their pitiful lungs. Some erupted in spontaneous contagion, their skins blistering, eyes melting, and organs oozing out, sloughing down to the deck in a sickly puddle of pus and gore. Fulgrim's perfected features contracted in disgust. Angron growled as his hand tightened around his great axe, while Perturabo discreetly moved away, consumed by his own loathing for those who too willingly embraced the repulsive gifts of the warp. Mortarion, however, no longer cared for the opinions of his brothers. He had arrived to fulfill his oath of being the first to land upon Holy Terra, and his delay had not been without good reason. With a throaty boom, he rasped out that he had prepared seven plagues to be dispersed across Terra, some to devastate the defenders, others to corrode their structures, but all intended to pollute the very souls of those who sought to defend the Emperor. But this conclave of traitors was to be short. As with his arrival, Horus declared that the Death Guard would lead the first attack, and with this, the Siege of Terra could finally begin. The invasion of the Throne World was to be precipitated by an orbital bombardment at a scale never before levied in the long annals of Terra's history. The combined fleets of the traitors had already brought devastation to the Sol system, and now they were fully prepared to bring their wrath unto the surface of the Emperor's domain. The vessels of the Death Guard, stationed in high orbit, unleashed atmospheric torpedoes that penetrated the upper stratosphere, leaving dense trails of greenish-yellow mist swept up by the winds to coat the world in a thick layer of toxic miasma. The Imperial Palace, that pinnacle of human architecture, received the brunt of their attack, yet there was to be not one corner of the world spared from their remorseless strikes. Void shields flared with a sickly ochre glow as they struggled to maintain power, as the defending forces were forced to reduce their range until only the palace itself was protected by their might. The surrounding landscapes, however, could not be spared. Fortified bastions, deeply knit defensive lines, and command posts were entirely obliterated with each orbital strike, blasting immense wounds into the ancient earth. To make matters worse, each detonation was followed by a creeping mephitis of death, silently drifting down through the clouds as the spreading diseases of Mortarion engulfed the besieged defenders. The use of deadly gases had always been feared throughout human history, and even in the 31st millennium, there could be no guarantees of survival from such an attack. Scores of guardsmen fell to their knees, clawing at their throats, as each inhalation brought the rot deeper and deeper, ravaging their internals from a disease which could never be cured. An immediate respiratory lockdown was implemented, with masks being distributed through the ranks. Yet this command came far too late, and many had already fallen from the first attack. Buildings exploded out, raining down streams of rubble, whilst the most distant posts of the guard were buried beneath the increasingly violent bursts of heavy ordnance, kicking up so much dust and smoke that the front trenches could only have been entirely destroyed. Yet, the bombardment suddenly ceased with an unnerving abruptness, bringing a weighty silence to smother the palace. Jagatai Khan, observing from his post, understood with immediate clarity that the cessation of orbital fire could signal only one possibility, that the ground assault was all but inevitable. Sure enough, the silence was punctuated by the faint rumble of landing thrusters, accompanied by the dim lights of drop pods, barely visible through the impossibly dense smog. The ground shuddered with each crash as scores of the Death Guard drop pods made planetfall before the main bombardments resumed, pummeling into the void shields with great cracks of burning fire. The Loyalist defenders desperately adjusted their Auspex devices to penetrate the fog, but the Marines were already there, marching through the miasma as an inexorable legion of death. The Barbarian Legion had always been suited for warfare amidst the most hostile of conditions. But since their metamorphosis into the Death Guard, this noxious landscape now felt less like a challenge to endure and more like a return to their natural home. The outer defenses were immediately compromised, already racked by the gushing plagues, and now this assault by the relentless scions of Nurgle was simply too much to hold back. They were not overwhelmed by some sense of tactical brilliance, but by the ceaseless advance of the Death Guard, impervious to their own toxins, and perfectly suited to the brutal realities of attrition warfare. Each snapping shot of the Imperial Lasguns did little but singe the oozing pus upon their armor as salvos of heavy bolter fire were levied in return, decimating swathes of the guard with every horrific burst. As the invasion progressed, the outer fields of the palace, designated as kill zones, started to bear an increasing resemblance to the toxic wastelands of Barbarus, with well-fortified trenches rapidly filling with a stagnant mix of poisonous muck and half-dissolved corpses. The gas masks were useless, with corrupting spores spreading through their systems, yet the gasping desperation of soldiers drowning in their own bodily fluids was entirely inaudible over the unending cacophony of this apocalyptic war. The Warhawk of the White Scars, who always viewed a rapid offense as being the best form of defense, chose to abandon Dorne's carefully planned orders by setting out with a strategy that had come to define the Great Khan. Mounting his jet bike, he led a vengeful charge, plunging directly into the toxic miasma, his curved blade flashing with each sweep as he cleaved lone members of the Death Guard apart before vanishing deeper into the swirling pollution. The White Scars followed their Gene Father's example, moving as lightning through the storm, initiating a series of brutal hit-and-run strikes to momentarily disrupt the Death Guard's inexorable advance. Even though he was a Primarch, the Khan was not impervious to the creeping infections of the warp. With each daring maneuver, he was struck by fetid blades and pestilent shot, which chewed through his flesh, eventually knocking him from his bike onto the blasted earth. From high above, Sanguinius, accompanied by his sanguinary guard, dove down to rescue the fallen Khan, with the symptoms of this sickness rapidly disappearing as he was brought closer to the Emperor's light. Yet with all of their heroism, the defenders still found themselves engaged in a war of attrition against an enemy raised to defy death. Each fallen Plague Marine simply added their decomposing mass to the growing corruption of the battlefield, with their brothers carelessly marching over the corpses, sparing no heed to those too weak to endure. But the Loyalist casualties had to be dealt with, as every fallen guardsman was transformed into a new vector for disease and death. In truth, the Death Guard did not need to achieve some masterful tactical victory here. They only needed to persist and endure, to spread the gifts of Nurgle far and wide, until the very core of Terror had been irredeemably corrupted. As the battle stretched on, the defending commanders could do little but watch, staring out into the dense fog, illuminated only by sporadic bursts of fire, knowing that the Death Guard marched on through the hell they had brought. But they were forced to admit to themselves that this was only the beginning of the true plague. With each passing day, the grounds of Terror grew ever more corrupted, to the point where the killing fields were now entirely unrecognizable as anything but a realm of death and disease. It was impossible to count the casualties or even to survey the dead, as the fallen corpses simply deliquesced with a horrifying rapidity, melting away into bubbling pools of organic matter from which noxious vapors arose to join in the greater miasma. The earth beneath the implacable Death Guard had transformed into a viscous morass, bearing more of a resemblance to infected gangrenous tissue than of even the most war-torn of soils. Each squelching step of their corroded boots left deep footprints that filled with a pus-like fluid, creating miniature incubation pools from which new strains of Nurgle's pernicious contagion arose. Jubilant Nurglings exhumed themselves from this fetid muck, crawling and dragging their decomposing forms to ride atop Plague Marines, belching forth clouds of flies and sprays of maggoty detritus. All of the blood and all of the putrescence simply mingled together, spreading through the violated earth, until the very walls of the outer bastions began to weep with a musty-smelling discharge, burning deep scars from the streams of purulent death. The bolter rounds, levied by the Death Guard, similarly carried the plagues of Nurgle, ensuring that each shot, even if not immediately fatal, would leave a festering wound which would soon spell an inevitable and painful demise. Their rusted blades, when dipped within the slimes of their own open sores, would then carry microscopic organisms that rapidly chewed through living flesh, causing slashed limbs to slough off, leaving not even the bones to be preserved. The Khan, looking out across the blasted field, noted with a sense of disgust that the Death Guard artillery batteries had not relented in their ceaseless saturation of the front, bombarding areas which had already been entirely claimed by the frontline troops of the 14th. No loyalist legion had ever displayed such a flagrant disregard for the lives of their brothers, but rather sadly, the children of Barbarus were all too used to being thrown into the meat grinder of war. Even during the Great Crusade, Mortarion had knowingly sent thousands of his legionnaires to their certain deaths, and this sickening tactic of attrition warfare had never been reversed nor paused. He was more than willing to sacrifice his legion, seeing their obliteration as being secondary to his ultimate goal of finally gaining revenge over the emperor who once stole his only opportunity to topple the malign overlords of his tainted home. With the toxic miasma of Nurgle growing ever thicker across Terra, the full effect of Mortarion's seven plagues had truly began to take root. Solid matter, be it biological or artificial, slowly started to weaken, manifesting first as a dull sweating, before progressing into the full liquefaction of the afflicted. Ancient structures, which had once withstood a millennia of erosion, began to slump down and flow as though wax caught beneath a flame. The plague winds also carried with them curious psychological effects, with the infected defenders finding their own senses to be skewed, their grasp on reality devolving into little more than a waking fever dream of hallucinogenic terror. But the fields were still only led by the Death Guard, and high above, within the flagships of the traitor fleet, the Pale King still stood, surveying and silently watching as the chaos unfurled. The Lord of Barbarus, now eternally pledged to Nurgle, felt his own blight. The stench surrounding him pervaded every surface. His corroded armor had been chewed apart by writhing maggots, and it was impossible for him to deny that the putrefaction of his flesh was anything but tortuous. Within his armor, he decayed. His skin, blighted and rotten, wept and oozed with putrescence, and this rancid wasting of his own body was something which he knew would last forevermore. He had sought for a meeting with Magnus under the guise of planning the next phase of the invasion, but in truth, he only wished to see the Crimson King in a desperate hope that the Cyclopean could somehow ease his unending pain. He hated this feeling of death leeching into his very soul, yet Magnus had been touched by the gifts of the warp for far longer and was far more in tune with the methods needed to harness their foul powers. Gently placing his hand upon the Death Lord's shoulder, Magnus imparted a spell, a psychic remedy, not anything like a cure, but just a treatment, to better intertwine the corrupting plagues of Nurgle with the decomposed dregs of humanity still present within the Primarch. Though it lasted but a moment, the effects were instantaneous. Mortarion breathed deeply and stood up from his once crooked posture, now towering once again as though unafflicted from the inborn rot. Make no mistake, for he was still the same demon Primarch as before. But this gift had helped him to embrace the growing death and to control it, rather than suffer beneath it. In a rare moment of compassion, Mortarion reached out and clutched the hand of the Crimson King, nodding without word, before taking up his scythe and departing from their chamber, now prepared to descend into the field and to seek out the Emperor for the final time. But if only he had known that even this momentary kindness was but a farce. There was no true fraternal love here, no brotherly honor in face of their shared transformations, and rather, Magnus simply needed Mortarion at a certain place and at a certain time in order to fulfill his own nefarious goals. For you see, the Crimson King wished to covertly breach the mysterious halls of the Imperial Dungeon, but in order to distract the defenders, he needed the Death Guard to crash into the Outer Palace, imbued with a sense of vigor that could only be attained when in the presence of an undead Primarch. He only saw Mortarion and his Barbaran dregs as blunt instruments to be used up and discarded, fit only to serve until the exact moment when their kind were no longer needed. Mortarion, however, would never learn of this deception, and as he made planetfall, we must wonder as to whether this was the final time that he felt a true bond with one of his fallen brothers. Across the Imperial Palace, we could safely say that the highest concentration of defenders were stationed both within the Sanctum Imperialis and upon the great bastion of the Lion's Gate. But beyond this, standing as a lone bulwark against the crashing tides of plague, was the Lion's Gate spaceport. This structure, towering high into the upper atmosphere of Terra, had always been the largest docking site for the Throne World, being capable of shuttling reinforcements and supplies down from low orbit, and if needed, could be used to evacuate the surviving defenders if defeat seemed all but inevitable. Being of such strategic importance, Dawn had stationed over 18,000 Marines of the Imperial Fists, supported by an assemblage of the Imperial Army who each knew that the fall of the port would cut off any potential for future support, descending to act as their salvation. Yet, upon the 11th day of Quintus, the Lion's Gate spaceport was overrun and consumed by a chaotic siege, commanded by the Primarch Perturabo. With its capture, Horus could use the great space elevators to shuttle down the entirety of Legio Mortis, a fallen Titan legion whose god engines had been corrupted and empowered by the foul energies of the Dark Mechanicum. By this point, much of the sieging had been commanded by Perturabo, who had joined his Iron Warriors to lead directly from the front. Nestled within his command throne, the Primarch of the Fourth initially appeared as more of an armored ogre than of a leader. But in truth, this was his element. Here, he was connected to the entirety of the siege, with every vox call, every auspex link, and every visual feed streaming directly into his augmented mind. He was enthralled, consumed in his own flow of finally applying his greatest strategic mind and greatest genius to the largest siege in galactic history. And yet all was not well for the Olympian. The Primarch had seen this battle as the final chance to prove his worth over that of his rival brother, Rogel Dorn. But he was quickly realizing that there could be no honor in such a victory if his armies had been tainted by the foul presence of demons. To make matters worse, Horus had since become so consumed by the powers of the warp that his command over the wider siege was now erratic and ironically, quite chaotic. In a moment of madness, he ordered for Perturabo to collect his Iron Warriors and to disperse them throughout the battlefield, leaving their command post undefended, whilst forcing the Olympian brothers to fight shoulder to shoulder with those who had felt the touch of the dark gods. Further, Horus declared that Perturabo had played his part, and that he should now secede his command to Mortarion. This, however, was the final straw. The Olympian, utterly consumed by disgust at the state of the traitor forces, recalled the entirety of his iron warriors and departed from Terra, leaving the bickering warbands to revel in their own squalor. But in the shadow of Perturabo's flight arose our Lord of Death. From within the growing haze of pestilent fog, reality itself surrendered to the coming of the Pale King. The fragile walls between our dimensions thinned, eroded down by the constant rot of Nurgle's plague, until finally, at long last, Mortarion, the savior of Barbarus, strode out to finally walk upon Holy Terra. Sided by his Death Shroud Terminators, he looked up to the Lion's Gate spaceport, which had already shuddered in response to his presence. With the uncountable casualties suffered on both sides from the prior siege, the surrounding grounds had been left as nothing short of a necropolis. The stench of putrefaction hung heavy over the dead. And yet, to Mortarion, this was the sweet perfume of victory, a scent more welcoming than of any incense ever burned in the Emperor's name. The spaceport, now under his control, was to be transformed to his exact specifications, desecrating the once pristine structure into the new command center of the entire siege. The ancient towers, which once brushed against the heavens, now writhed as though they were the pained limbs of a living organism desperately attempting to shake off the infection of an aggressive parasite. Gleaming adamantium struts and buttresses softened and curled in on themselves, sprouting writhing tendrils to replace the time-tested foundations. Ferrocrete platforms developed turgid pustules, bursting beneath the intolerable heat of war, only to spill out a thick overflow of corrosive fluids to melt down and reshape the old port. Even the docking clamps that once secured void ships and inbound cargo had now been transfigured into great ossified claws, grasping out at the putrescent fumes with their arthritic and twisted fingers. But by the end of this transformation, the spaceport was to be Mortarion's prize, a fortress of plagues beyond compare, perhaps the most disgusting and pestiferous of structure to be found outside of Nurgle's personal realm of chaos. The loading bays were now great suppurating wounds, occasionally bursting open to disgorge bloated, tick-like flies, carrying lesser demons through the air to be dropped into the fiercest reaches of the great siege. From this newly claimed stronghold, Mortarion gazed out towards his next objective, being of the Marmax Bastion of the Lion's Gate. The defensive network had already been pummeled by the combined armies of the traitor legions, but now, the future of their siege relied entirely upon its fall, as the Sanctum Imperialis could not be assailed, whilst the fortress still stood. Mortarion had already issued the assault, but according to Typhus, their forces had stalled. The former first captain and his corrupted gene father once shared an unshakable bond forged from their nightmarish upbringing upon the world of Barbarus. And yet, their new relationship, rebirthed amidst the rising tides of plague, had turned entirely sour. Mortarion was content with the Death Guard methodically trudging through the ruins of the Outer Palace. But Typhus was far more keen to wet his blade on the blood of the Emperor's dogs. And so he revealed one crucial secret to goad the Pale King into an attack. Nathaniel Garrow, former captain of the Death Guard, was one of the loyalist figures condemned to die upon the blasted fields of Istvan. And yet, by taking flight upon the vessel of the Eisenstein, he was able to escape death, bringing word of Horus's heresy to the wider Imperium. However, the Knight Errant had since joined with the defensive forces upon Terra, and as fate would have it, the Loyalist brother had been stationed directly within the Marmax Bastion. Thus, the opportunity to fell or even corrupt this Oathbreaker to the ways of chaos was something that the Death Lord simply could not ignore. As the siege renewed in its violent fervor, Mortarion joined his forces upon the field until finally, at long last, through the haze of pestilent smoke, he was met with the sight of the Knight Errant. Garrow, incorruptible as ever, rejected the gift of demonic power, and neither did he submit to the Primarch's offer of a quick death, granted in some twisted ideal of mercy to repay the past honors earned from the times when the two still fought side by side. Thus the two drew their weapons, Mortarion wielding his gargantuan scythe, and Garrow unsheathing the ancient, near-mythical blade known as Libertas. The duel commenced with a true explosion as their blades clashed against one another in a howling torrent of impossibly fast strikes, casting out flames of sickly green with each deft parry. Garrow had no time to think, no time to contemplate, as Mortarion was a whirlwind, a demonic beast surrounding him with slashes from every angle, slowly chipping away at his armor, biting down into weak, vulnerable flesh. By this point, it was clear to any onlookers that Mortarion was simply playing with his wayward captain. The battle could have been ended with a single coup de grace, but Garrow had surrendered his chance to die a swift and painless death. Yet in a moment of alacrity, the loyalist captain saw his chance to thrust back, burying the blade of Libertas deep into Mortarion's ragged throat. In response, Garrow was cut down, left to breathe his last upon the blasted fields of terror, looking up at his old Jean father quenching the oozing and rapidly festering wound. The Primarch would not die from this, but the old scar would remain as a memory of the Knight Errant who never abandoned his duties and who stood defiant against chaos to the bitter end. With each passing day, the traitor forces pushed deeper and deeper into the defensive networks of the Imperial Palace at a rate which would soon spell out their final and terrible victory. Though Dorne wished to pull back, consolidating the remaining survivors in a more fortified location, almost as a means of delaying the inevitable, the Great Warhawk held a far different view on the fated course of war. The Loyalists were still banking on the arrival of the Ultramarines, as their entire fleet was bound directly to Terra. Yet with the tumultuous flows of the warp, none could be sure of exactly when they would arrive. But even if they did arrive in time, the Marines would then be faced with a new challenge of logistics. Their heavy tanks and Mechanicus engines would be too large to send via drop pods, and the most efficient means of making planetfall with such an army would be to utilize the great elevators of a spaceport. Thus the Khan drafted up his final desperate plan to sally out from the palace and to retake the fetid bastion of the Lion's Gate spaceport, at once securing a landing site for the Ultramarines, whilst also knocking the Death Guard out of the war. Dorne, pushed to the brink by his insurmountable task of leading the overall defense of Terra, chose neither to fight nor to plea against this foolish maneuver of severing their own armies. He would have sooner had his brother remain within the greater bulwark. But by this point, there was no use in squabbling, and so he made no attempts at halting what he personally saw as strategic insanity. Nevertheless, the Khan mustered the remaining forces of the White Scars and called upon an old ally, Ilya Ravalion of the Departamento Munitorum, to aid him in assembling a greater army. Moving through the lines, she ordered for the gathering of countless tanks and transports, each of which would be environmentally sealed against the stagnant clouds of plague to protect the human crews within. This force, renamed as the 1st Terran Armored Regiment, would support the coming siege by bombarding the tainted engines of the traitors, whilst the Scars themselves would mount jet bikes, cleaving through the front lines as a single unstoppable charge. The Imperial Army crashed into the putrescent mass of the Death Guard, striking at the bewildered traitors who hardly expected an attack this deep within their tainted lands. But from the death came new allies to aid in their defense. The Plague Marines were not easily bested, and the putrescent battlefield only gave rise to the demons of Nurgle, shoring up gaps in their ranks, whilst bogging down the Imperials in yet another brutal war of attrition. The Scars were torn down from their bikes and drowned in the fetid muck of the field, their shattered armors filling with a corrosive mix of blood and pus. Plague towers, insurmountable demon engines to Nurgle, were peppered with heavy cannon fire from the armored regiment, finally bringing them crashing down to the earth in a great sodden slump. Yet, there, in the middle of the carnage, in the great whirlpool of this gangrenous ruin, stood the pale King of Barbarus, and directly opposed was the Warhawk of Chogoris. The two had fought before, dueling as mortals amidst the ruins of Prospero, but now, newly reborn as a demonic prince to Nurgle, the comparison seemed truly laughable. His change was grotesque and utterly disgusting. The Primarch had always seemed uncomfortable in his own skin, but he had now cast aside that ill-fitting facade of humanity, exposing the true depths of rot and decay that surrounded his very soul. There was no exchange of words, no last attempts at stalling the battle, as the two fell into their duel, once more lost within the fever dream of war. Mortarion was faster now, stronger than he had ever been, with the powers of the warp flowing through his veins, fueling each slash of his scythe, finally allowing him to outpace the Warhawk and to gain the upper hand. Yet the silence of their battle was then punctuated with the Khan outwardly mocking Mortarion for having embraced the very thing which he always hated. This, however, was painfully true. And each word only served to sting Mortarion right down to his blackened heart. He never wished for this. He never wanted to become a pathetic servant to the gods, to be a slave to the darkest of powers. And in truth, his own rationalization of his newfound strengths was merely a coping mechanism to cover up the fact that he was too weak to endure. This venomous talk only grew to its peak, with the admittance that Jagatai knew Mortarion's secret, in that he had surrendered to Nurgle amidst a moment of weakness, and that he could not withstand the same trials which the Khan so proudly resisted. This was the final straw. Blinded by hatred, his shame and fears exposed only to be mocked and ridiculed, Mortarion unleashed his rage in an overwhelming sweep, impaling the Warhawk upon his scythe, lifting his body up high before slamming him back down into the ruined earth below. Rasping out, barely coherent through his exasperated fury over this accusation of weakness, he sought some form of refuge in the simple defense that, from his newborn powers, that he could never die. The Khan knew this, of course. And yet, with the final fleeting vestiges of his strength, the Warhawk reached out, dragging himself deeper against the hilt of the corroded scythe, something which Mortarion only realized when it was far too late. With a single strike, Chagatai Khan slashed out with his Tao, decapitating the decrepit head of the Pale King, who fell back into an explosion of immaterial matter, banished back into the nightmare of the warp, finally sparing Terra from his sickening presence. The Warhawk, mortally wounded from his act, looked up in his final moments, watching as Mortarion experienced the closest thing to death that a demon could feel before falling back himself, his victory soon drowned out by the enveloping darkness of his own inevitable demise. Mortarion was gone. Not dead, but cast so far from this realm that Nurgle himself would be forced to piece his broken soul back together, remolding him again into a new, ever more disgusting effigy of ruinous decrepitude. The Khan, however, was dying. Yet with the White Scars finally seizing control of the spaceport, his broken body was eventually to be found and recovered, where he was taken back to the Imperial Palace and healed by the grace of the Emperor's presence. But the Siege of Terra had not halted just because two Primarchs were incapacitated and someone would need to step up to take command of the fleeting dregs of the 14th. Ever since the metamorphosis of their legion, First Captain Typhus had held an immense sway over his brothers, and so it only seemed natural for him to seize the mantle of leadership and to bring the great siege to its bloody end. He had heard of Mortarion's defeat, but felt no need to hunt down the Scars, seeing his gene father's obsession with revenge as being foolish when compared to the far grander ambitions of the traitor forces. With the Lion's Gate spaceport now back in the hands of the Loyalists, Typhus rallied the surviving forces of the Death Guard and set out on a new mission to seize control of the Astronomicon, hoping to halt any Imperial efforts at relighting the Great Beacon. The port could not be retaken, but the Death Guard planned to further delay the arrival of the Ultramarines by concealing the guiding light of the Emperor's blazing signal. The Death Guard were somewhat successful in this attack, with Typhus leading his forces into the depths of the Hollow Mountain, besting a defensive force led by Corswin, his Dark Angels, and of Sigismund with his remaining brothers. The outcome of this battle may have been different if the forces of Chaos were interested in maintaining a fair playing field, but the time for honorable duels was long over, and now victory had to be seized by any means necessary. Typhus, transformed at this point into a bloated behemoth of plague, led his cancerous troop in a song, conjured from the roiling depths of the warp. This psychic storm, rippling through the air to tear apart reality itself, was simply too much to bear for the ragged defenders. This was not a conventional battle by any means of the word, and rather it was a ritual, with the Imperials only serving as sacrificial lambs to be offered up to the Dark Gods in return for unmatched power. Yet, even in the face of death, they still fought. They cleaved through the fetid Scions, hacking away at the Neverborn as best they could, before being bogged down by wave after wave of necrotic flesh, dragging themselves out from the muck to be reformed as beings of pure undeath. Typhus was always their goal, with the Imperials hoping that his death would end the psychic song, and yet there was another way to end this madness. Euphrates Keeler, Remembrancer to the Lunar Wolves, had at this point started in her sacrificial prayer amidst the faithful, channeling the fleeting essence of the fallen across Terra to both banish the forces of the Death Guard and to reignite the blazing light of the Astronomicon. As a blinding avalanche of holy fire, this song echoed out, burning away the pestilent slaves to Nurgle, entirely scouring the regrouped 14th from the face of this world. Typhus himself, raging and screaming against the Imperial light, was crushed by the oncoming wave, his physical form banished and obliterated, soul cast into the warp to be collected as a treasure for the old grandfather. But with this, the bulk of the Death Guard had been repelled from Holy Terra, and their remaining impact upon the wider siege was relegated only to the deeds of scattered survivors, pledging their subservience to champions far stronger than they. None of the remaining troops proved to be very impactful, as it was not long after the relighting of the Astronomicon that Horus was bested in a climactic duel with the Emperor, thus spelling the end to the Siege of Terra and to the wider heresy. In the following years, the surviving Imperial forces set out on a great purge, scouring the wider galaxy from any last traces of chaos, which may have found purchase within the darkness of the void. During this campaign, the forces of the Dark Angels surrounded Barbarus, the old homeworld, to the Death Guard, and subjected it to its final fate of destruction. The toxic surface, once ruled by the Overlords, and then by Mortarion and his brothers, was scoured under the weight of virus bombs, cleansing their ancient presence once and for all. The surviving Death Guard, some of whom had fled from Terra, and others who had been revived within the warp, felt an unnatural calling, a siren song to delve into the Eye of Terra and to seek out a world formed entirely from plague. This planet, once named as Eleothada, had been claimed by Mortarion, who reformed it into a pestilent home for the Death Guard, whilst convalescing from his own death at the hands of the Khan. Some of the 14th, led by the banished Typhus, looked upon this planet and the pathetic state of their gene father and simply chose to leave, finally done with suffering through the intolerable weakness of one so wretched and shameful. Others, however, who possessed stronger loyalties to the savior of Barbarus, chose to remain, though they did not yet realize that this would curse them to an existence of pitiful isolation, as Mortarion had sought to close himself off from the chaotic affairs of the mortal galaxy. None had the chance to see nor speak with the Primarch, for he simply remained within his personal dwellings. But if any were to look within, then they would have been met with a sight most tragic. He was a ruin, a mass of fetid flesh and pestilent death, an effigy of plague given form through the immaterial might of Grandfather Nurgle. Yet we must wonder that if we were to burn away the plague, of what then would be left of the man? But with this, my dearest friends, I do believe that we have now come to our end. Thank you all for listening to this tale on the foul involvement of the Death Guard upon Terra. But I must once again close this chapter once more. And so as I go, know that I will wish each and every one of you with a very warm goodbye.